I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, another edition of Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. A new report in the British medical journal The Lancet imagines a world that undergoes a great food transformation, where humans shift from animals to plants as a source of protein to improve individual health and to help sustain the environment. But is that kind of diet good for everybody? And what else needs to be done in the cause of sustainability besides changing how we eat? The Nutrition Diva is here to explain what the study says and what it may mean for how we envision the concept of healthy eating in the future. Plus, theater critic Jaywin Russick reviews Charlie and the Chocolate Factory at Baltimore's Hippodrome Theater. Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us on this rainy Monday. At least it's rainy here in Baltimore. Today on Midday, it's Smart Nutrition. In a recent report in the respected British medical journal The Lancet, scientists who study nutrition and food policy took on a heady and ambitious task. They sought to make recommendations about what people should eat to improve their health and to do it in a way that enables us to provide enough food for the world's projected 10 billion people by 2050. As well, they want to do it in a way that protects and sustains the environment. It's a complicated Rubik's Cube that places itself smack dab in the middle of the meat versus plant-based camps, and it exposes the tension that sometimes arises between health concerns for individuals and concern for the broader health of the planet writ large. So here on Midday, when we need to tackle the complex problems around nutrition and health, we turn to the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. Monica is an author and licensed nutritionist who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. Always good to see you.
Hi, Tom.
And listeners, I got a feeling that a bunch of you are going to want to weigh in on this. 410-662-8780. That's how you do it on the phone. Our email is midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle @midday_WIPR. And we are also streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So Monica, our director and engineer, Luke Spicknall, when people ask him what he does for a living, he says that he's the director and engineer of Midday, and people say, is that a radio show? And Luke usually says, it's not so much a show, but ever since Tom took over, it's really more of a cry for help, you know? And I can't disagree. But in this instance, today's topic, we really do have a cry for help. It's a different kind of cry that Luke's talking about, but this is really quite wild. This thing comes out in The Lancet, very respected journal of medicine in Britain, and the National Geographic has a piece about it. And the headline is, "Eating Meat Has Dire Consequences for the Planet." Did they get this headline right? I mean, it's a 47-page report by 37 respected scientists. Have 37 respected scientists said, "Okay, kids, no more meat"? Is that the takeaway from this thing?
Well, they lifted one of the many recommendations in this report to highlight in their headline, probably because it was going to get a rise out of people. You know, this, as you said in your
clickbait
intro, yeah, this does get to a very active debate about what role animal protein should play in our diets. But in truth, this was only one of many things that the commission raised for us to consider. And to just put it in a little bit of perspective, they were not saying that we should all become vegans. They were quick to say this is not an all or nothing proposition, but that we may need to look at the proportion of meat to plant-based foods in our diets. But that was also just one of many things that they raised that deserve our consideration as we tackle not just this question of what diet is healthiest for humans, but the perhaps more ambitious goal of this report was, what diet can our planet sustain as our population gets larger? And those two, there's some reconciliation that has to be done between those two questions, because the answers are not 100% overlapping.
It seems like that is a very ambitious thing to say, okay, we have to eat healthy so that, you know, individually we are in better health mm-hmm. and we're sustaining ourselves. But sometimes to do that is really hard in a way that is not harmful to the environment. So how, I mean, you would think that if you just ate plants and, you know, ate everything naturally, that that wouldn't be bad for the environment. I mean, that's oversimplifying things, but has anybody ever undertaken this kind of study in the past? I mean, that's trying to do both things, trying to do the sustainability side as well as the healthy side?
Certainly, we saw in the most recent Dietary Guidelines for Americans, which came out in 2015, every 5 years we update this report. One of the things that distinguished that from previous iterations was they did start to address this topic of sustainability. They added that as one of the values that they wanted to try to solve for. And so it's not the first time that people have recognized we may need to broaden the lens a little bit and not look purely at what's right for human bodies, but also what's right for the planet. I will say that they got a little criticism from that about not staying in their lanes, that, you know, people said, look, your job is to just tell us what we're supposed to be eating. We'll let the environmentalists worry about sustainability because that's just too big a complex a topic to get right. And then, you know, on the other hand, for those dietary guidelines, their mission is not solely to decide what's right for human bodies. Part of their goal or their mission is also to decide how we support our farmers, because those guidelines are issued by the Department of Agriculture, who have sort of a dual mission to look at health, but also to support those industries that employ a lot of people in this country.
Yeah, and
it's just a lot of tensions.
Yeah, a lot of tensions, and we're not the only ones experiencing that tension. Just a couple of days ago on Tuesday up in Canada, they had a big report come out also saying folks should eat less meat, less dairy, and more plant-based stuff. And there's a big meat industry and a big dairy industry in Canada.
Who are not happy.
Not happy at all.
Yeah, this is their version of our dietary guidelines. And it is interesting to see that all of these are sort of shifting simultaneously in the same direction. If they don't all reach exactly the same conclusions, we can definitely see a drift here and a growing consensus that we need to at least consider the proportion of plants to animals. I will say, though, that nobody's arguing that we would all be healthier if we all ate more vegetables, if we ate more salad, if we ate more broccoli. That's not what's really being debated here. This really comes down to the issue of where we're going to get our protein, mm-hmm. which is just sort of one aspect of diet, but it's an important one, and whether we want to get our protein from plant-based sources or animal-based sources. And there's pros and cons on either side.
And what's good for a 45-year-old man may not be optimal and good for a 15-year-old woman, right? I mean, so that's part of the problem. I mean, Psychology Today had what amounts to a big rebuttal of this report, a 10-point rebuttal. In this, the author states that even the authors of this report, the Lancet report, admit that it falls short, the getting protein from plant-based sources falls short for growing children, adolescent girls, pregnant women, aging adults, malnourished, and impoverished people. So that obviously—
What proportion of the society does that include?
That's a lot of people.
Well, one of the advantages, just from purely a health perspective, of getting more of our protein from plant-based sources is that it comes along with some other good stuff. You usually get a lot of fiber along with that. That's a good thing. One of the disadvantages, though, is that plant-based sources of protein tend to have less protein per serving, and the protein is of a lower biological quality. And that's not a value judgment about meat or plants or vegetarians or meat eaters. This is just about biochemical reality. You get not as complete a set of the essential amino acids, and the amino acids are also a little bit harder to liberate from the food. It's a little bit less digestible. So when we shift to more plant-based sources of protein, we do give up something in terms of quality and quantity of protein. And there are some people for whom that, you know, is not ideal.
So is it safe to say that the most efficient way to get protein is to get the highest quality protein is to eat meat?
Absolutely. Yeah. If you're just talking about the amount of protein per calorie, the amount of protein per serving, and also the quality of the protein, yes, that is That is a statement. And, you know, one of the things that I took a little bit of exception with in the Eat Lancet report was the statement that red meat consumption is unhealthy, that excessive red meat consumption will make you less healthy. And that seemed like a very, they were so careful about so many of their statements, very carefully worded and sort of, you know, leaving room for all of the complexity. But here they seem to be a little bit categorical. And this is what I think has gotten the dander up of some folks who see the evidence differently.
Yeah, it's sort of the sweeping statement, you know, red meat equals cancer.
It's bad for you.
We're done. Yeah. Right.
So a lot of this is drawn from epidemiological data sets where we look at large groups of people over decades and try to see patterns. The problem is, and in those data sets, we do see that the people that eat the most meat often have a lot more health problems and higher disease risks than the vegetarians. One problem with that is that so many of those data sets, the people who were eating a lot of meat were eating it in the context of a diet that was not that healthy and a lifestyle that wasn't that healthy. Those same people were also eating fewer vegetables. They were exercising less. They were more likely to smoke. They were drinking more. And so, you know, they were, as I say, eating a lot of meat and red meat in the context of a not so healthy diet. Meanwhile, a lot of the epidemiological data we have on vegetarian diets and the benefits of those are from the Adventist studies. And those are people who are eating vegetarian protein in the context of a super healthy diet, also much lower in sugar, much lower in processed foods. So it was a little bit of an unfair fight to be comparing the outcomes of these vegetarians who were also living extremely healthy lifestyles with the outcomes of meat eaters who were also living not so healthy lifestyles and drawing conclusions from that about whether red meat is unhealthy.
Yeah,
and again, I'm talking just about human health. I'm bracketing for a moment the question about the impact on the environment
right.
and on the planet.
Right. So the Psychology Today piece also lists as their number one problem with this report from in the Lancet Journal is this the methodology that they use, this epidemiological approach to it. She writes it's tragically flawed. you know, the whole notion of nutritional epidemiology, these large studies, you know, all this data, it's not a clinical thing. They're not studying individual human beings, you know, times 100 or 200 or 500 over a period of years. They are looking at these this mishmash of studies that have already taken place.
They're data mining, you know, and there's some value in that. As she points out in her piece in Psychology Today, from this you could raise really good hypotheses, but which then need to be tested. You can't just skip right to the conclusion. And so often when we finally do have the money and the time to test some of these hypotheses that come out of these epidemiological data sets, we find out they were wrong. They made sense. They might have seemed intuitive. The correlation might have been extremely robust. But when they actually test it, they do not bear out. And, you know, there have been some randomized controlled trials, for example, done on people eating red meat in the context of really healthy diets, and they don't see a decline in health biomarkers. They don't take place over 30 years. That's the problem. And they might only involve 100 people instead of 100,000 people. But, you know, we have to at least be willing to look at those kinds of data points as well.
Is there a way of determining sort of what the optimal balance between meat protein and plant-based protein is? Has anybody else taken a shot at that ever?
Purely from a health perspective, not the sustainability piece. I think that we can see what a minimum amount of animal protein might be to foster maximum muscle protein synthesis. And for example, that could be very important for people who are getting older. They tend to lose muscle mass. We all do as we get older. And it accelerates as we get into our 60s and 70s. And this leads to a lot of frailty. And we have research showing that if you can get 25 to 30 grams of high quality protein 2 times a day, you can really forestall a lot of that muscle protein loss in the body. So we could back that out and say, okay, if our goal is to try to get 2 healthy servings of high quality protein per day, then everything after that can be plant-based. So that might be, you know, a Greek yogurt for breakfast and a small serving of chicken or beef or something in the evening with dinner, or it's your midday meal. And then that third meal of the day, that can be the plant-based source. And that sort of fits in with what, you know, despite all of the sound and fury about this, when you look at the recommendations, they are leaving room for us to have a serving of animal protein most days of the week, a serving of dairy every day if we want it. That for some reason they were extremely stingy with the eggs. That was one thing that I couldn't quite make sense of. You would think that in the scope of animal proteins, that would be one of the more sustainable sources, because chickens, one chicken can make lots of eggs.
Yeah.
And they're extremely high quality protein. They're very affordable. They're very compact. They're very flexible. And yet they really got dissed in this report. And I'm not sure why.
It always fascinated me that the tagline for eggs for a long time was the incredible edible egg, as if the only thing they could think of to say good about eggs is that you could eat them.
Yes, but
they should come up with something better than that.
But 20 or 30 years later, you're still quoting their slogan. So
exactly.
I think it
it's worked. A great slogan.
I think
it's
it
just worked. It's just a little dicey when it comes to the substance. So, and of course, you know, you mentioned people who are aging, little kids who are growing, you know, and they're growing quickly. Young women, this study also even itself mentions, you know, young girls who are menstruating, they're losing a lot of iron and protein and stuff through that process. I mean, so that they've got different needs. For the amount of protein is going to differ to each human being at different stages of his or her life, right?
Well, one of the things that's drawn a little criticism about this report is they actually went to the extraordinary measure of laying out the ideal diet, like down to the gram.
Yeah, it's like 31 grams of this and right. 2.6 grams of that.
Right, exactly. For every food group, I think it's 198 grams of fish, but 203 grams of poultry, but only, you know.
It sounds like it's a pretty exact science.
Well, it definitely creates the impression that they have got this nailed down, but that's obviously a little silly. There's going to be some variation, and maybe they're just saying, you know, divided by everybody on the planet, this is what it works out to. And I think they acknowledge that we're going to have to adjust that to suit different dietary needs, to cultures, availability. You know, we're not going to nail this ideal diet per person, but maybe it's just a benchmark that we can begin from.
It's Smart Nutrition today on Midday with the nutrition diva herself, Monica Reinagle. We'll have a link to her website at WIPR.org/midday, where you can sign up for Monica's newsletter and get her nutrition news and tips by email. You can also ask Monica a question when we come back from a quick break. 410-662-8780. That's our number. Our email, midday@WIPR.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR. You can also catch us on the WIPR Facebook page, where we are streaming as we speak. Before we take a break, we've got some sad news to report from the world of the arts here in Baltimore. Spencer Hammond, one of our city's great musical figures, particularly in church music, died this morning. He was for many years the director of music at Douglas Memorial Community Church, while the great preacher and civil rights activist Marion Baskin was the pastor there. They were an amazing team, and their tenure at Douglas will long be remembered as one of the most fruitful and significant partnerships in Baltimore history. I was proud to be one of Spencer's many friends and to be among his many, many admirers. Spencer Hammond was 88 years old. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be back after this break.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
The JBs, Pass the Peas, 1972. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, the question of impeachment of the president. As the partial government shutdown grinds on day after day and the specter of corruption and possible conspiracy with Russia hover like smog over the Trump administration, Calls for impeachment are coming from freshman members of the new Congress, as well as more seasoned representatives. But is impeachment, which heretofore is not supported by the congressional leadership, an appropriate action by the legislative branch? And if it turns out to be appropriate, is now the time? Are there other actions that Congress could take to address the concerns about Trump's behavior in office? We're going to talk about it with Yoni Applebaum, who's written the cover story in the next edition of The Atlantic magazine. It's entitled Impeach Trump. We're also going to talk about it with political scientist and author Yasha Monk from the Johns Hopkins School for International Studies. He's going to join us as well. His recent piece in Slate is basically a response to Yoni Applebaum's piece in The Atlantic. It's called The Case Against Impeaching Trump. So we're going to talk about that tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, it's Smart Nutrition. We're talking about the best diets for both individual health and the health of the planet with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. Monica is an author and a licensed nutritionist who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. To join our conversation, you can call us at 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org. You can drop us a tweet at midday. WIPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, that would be swell, at Tom Hall, WIPR. And you can catch us on the WIPR Facebook page. So, Monica, let's go to the phones. We have Barbara in Baltimore. Barbara, welcome to Midday with Monica Reinagle.
Hi. Monica, I wanted to get some information about vegan diets in newborns that are having breast milk and vegan diet only.
Well, any baby that's exclusively breastfed for the first months of their life, I guess I don't know whether we would technically consider that a vegan diet. I mean, we don't consider cow's milk to be vegan, but that breast milk is going to supply all of the nutrition perfectly for that baby until they begin to wean onto solid food. So I guess the real question is, you know, when we start to introduce foods, when a baby is no longer exclusively breastfed, and again, if the diet is still being supplemented with breast milk, you're going to be getting that high quality protein and those nutrients from the breast milk. So I think the critical question becomes when the baby is fully weaned and completely dependent on diet, is a vegan diet the best or appropriate for a baby? Would that be fair to say, Barbara?
I think the child at this point is breastfeeding maybe once a day, and the remainder of the diet, the child at this point is 15 months old, and the remainder of the diet is totally vegan.
Mm-hmm. And presumably that will eventually become 100%. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of reasons that people choose a vegan diet that may have to do with religious beliefs, ethical considerations, a commitment to certain values like sustainability. You know, there's a lot of really good, valid reasons. As a nutritionist, I have to say that from a purely biological standpoint, I'm not sure that a vegan diet is the ideal diet for humans, especially young growing humans, but it can certainly be accomplished. So if those other values are important, it is possible to raise healthy vegan children, but you do have to work a little bit harder to make sure that they get certain critical nutrients. And this is true for vegans across the board, adult vegans as well, but it's especially important for kids to make sure that they have the B12, the iron, the calcium, the nutrients that might come a little bit more easily in a diet that incorporated some animal foods. You have to be careful to make sure that those nutritional requirements are being met. Possible? Absolutely. Nutritionally ideal? I don't believe so, but when I have people who are committed to that lifestyle for some reason, then my task becomes, oh, let's make sure that you do it well.
Because there are instances where you may have to eat a lot more of something that's plant-based to get the same amount of protein as you would if you're eating a meat-based thing.
Exactly right.
This was so there's a caloric impact, that kind of stuff, or there could be, I guess, ostensibly.
There is. And what that means is that leaves a lot less or a lot fewer calories for discretionary spending, if you will, you know, because you're going to be spending so much more of your calorie budget just to get your protein needs met and your other nutrient needs met, then there's less room for treats.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that call, Barbara. We appreciate it. Yeah, when it comes to discretion, that's when things get very, very dark in my house. So when we talk about the sustainability part of this, and as we mentioned in the first part of the show, this Eat Lancet Commission report tried to reconcile eating healthy and sustaining the environment at the same time. Nature magazine weighed in on this not too long ago, saying that the food system is a major driver of climate change. Changes in land use, depletion of fresh water resources, and pollution of aquatic and terrestrial ecosystems through excessive nitrogen and phosphorus inputs. So what we plant, where we plant it, what we, what animals we have grazing in our pastures really do affect an awful lot of things through the chain.
It's a closed system. And, you know, this commission worked for 3 years to put together this report. And I bet they spent the entire first year just trying to come up with a workable definition of sustainability, because there are so many different things that you could look at and include, and a limited amount of data to draw from to try to understand what the impact of all these choices are. Something, though, that did come out in the report but tends to be falling by the wayside in the reporting and in the response to the report was one of the most critical things that we could all do to have a positive impact, regardless of whether we do or do not choose to eat meat, and that is cutting down on the grotesque amount of food that is wasted. About, you know, you're talking about the outputs and the costs of the food that we produce being high and being a factor in climate change. But when you consider that about a third of the food that we produce ends up in the landfill, that's just sickening. And not only does that mean that we paid those environmental costs to produce food that nobody ate, but then it goes on to have sort of a double whammy effect, because as that food decomposes in the landfill, it itself becomes a new generator of greenhouse gases. So, reducing food waste is an enormous thing that we could do to move towards a more sustainable food system, and everyone can participate in that, whether or not they choose to eat meat. So if you're already a vegan and feeling like you're off the hook from this report, but you're not doing everything that you can to reduce food waste, well, you're not off the hook quite yet. And this is an area that, you know, there are a lot of ways to respond to this report. There's things that we could look at as individual eaters, as things that we might do, but then there are also implications for industry and for, you know, if you work in a food service industry, whether that's a school or a restaurant or a hospital, what can you do within your culture, within your system, to put into place practices that would cut down on food waste? Because that could have a very dramatic impact on the sustainability question. So let's not let that get lost in our debate over plant versus animal and, you know, where we all settle on that. We all have a positive role to play in reducing food waste.
Yeah, and in the moral ironies of all of this, I mean, right here in our own city in Baltimore, we have a quarter of the children in our town living below the poverty line. They don't have access to healthy food. They're living in food deserts where it's very difficult. It's two or three bus transfers to get to the nearest grocery store, and then we're throwing away a third of the food. I mean, it boggles the mind and drives you nuts.
Yeah, and there are certainly agencies and organizations that have focused on this as their sole mission and attacking it from every way that they can, from the, you know, the food supply chain to some of those, you know, sort of outputs. Really creative work being done in the restaurant industry, in hospitals. You know, I don't know, hopefully you haven't been in the hospital recently, but one of the big changes is a lot of hospitals are moving towards what they call room service. So instead of just piling up a stack of trays and dropping it off in all the patients' rooms, the patients actually order from a menu what they want to eat when they want to eat it, and they've worked it out so that can
be possible.
And this has had a huge impact on how much food gets wasted in hospitals.
Monica Reinagle is the nutrition diva. It's Smart Nutrition here on Midday. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can catch us on the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming, or you can send us a tweet @MiddayWIPR. Let's go to Facebook. Dave makes a comment. It seems like there's more kombucha popping up in the stores these days. What do you think of kombucha, and how will it fit into daily life? Am I pronouncing that right even?
Kombucha.
Yeah. I don't even know what that is.
It's a fermented tea. It's a probiotic food. I think it's pretty sustainable because I've been brewing kombucha at my house from the same starter culture that I started with a year and a half ago. So so in terms of the sustainability question...
You ain't wasting anything.
It's pretty sustainable. and it's a pleasant little, you know, lightly carbonated drink. And the main attribute that it offers to a diet is that it can be a source of beneficial bacteria for the gut, which we've talked about here on Smart Nutrition in the past. It's one of those other really growing areas of research and interest in the nutrition community is what role these bacteria play in our gut. Didn't come up in this Eat Lancet report because it is certainly plant-based and pretty sustainable and not to the detriment of anyone's health anyway.
Well, thanks for that comment. Dave, we have an email from Tom who says, I take whey orotain isolate 25 grams with breakfast every morning. Do you think this is a good thing for me and for the planet? Whey orotain isolate.
Whey protein is a very high quality protein, very efficient source of protein. So if you were looking for a way to efficiently get that sort of maximal effect from the protein, that's as good a way as any. As good a way as any. Do you hear what I did there?
Yeah, that was pretty slick.
Yeah. And, you know, it is an animal-sourced protein. It comes, obviously, it's a dairy product. It is a byproduct of cheese manufacture, though. One of the reasons that we see whey protein, not only is it a good quality protein, but we had a lot of whey sitting around from all the cheese that we made. So in a way, it's a way to recycle, you know, some of those calories and those protein grams. But yeah, it's a good source of protein, but it is an animal source of protein. So if you are looking at your diet, trying to kind of reset the proportions, that would one that you would put in the animal column.
Speaking of whey, depending on how you spell it, we are whey as a country overweight. That's another issue here. I mean, we're throwing away a third of what we don't eat. We've got all sorts of things that do have a clear deleterious effect on the environment in terms of the number of animals out there and the number of, you know, the what we're growing and where we're growing. But ultimately, Americans in particular are as a group just heavier than we should be.
Oh, not Americans in particular. I don't.
Well, that's what I understand. I mean, is that so? You can disabuse me of this.
We've successfully exported this lifestyle, you know, pretty much globally. So this is
because I'm under the impression that the Mediterranean diet in Italy and, you know, Southern Europe is much nicer, and the people are much healthier, and that Asians have, generally speaking, a much healthier diet.
We got there first in terms of epidemic levels of overweight and obesity, but everybody's catching up with us. Oh. But so this is something that, you know, is a global concern, you know, the growing number of people that are overweight. It's a little delicate here because, you know, when you're trying to calculate how much food you need to raise in order to feed 10 billion people, you know, you're trying to come up with a total number of calories. It's one computation that you might start with. But it takes a lot more calories to maintain a body that's 30 or 50 pounds overweight. So one way that we could make our diets a little bit more sustainable is to only eat as many calories as we need to maintain a healthy weight. But you can imagine that's going to be a somewhat controversial proposal. We don't want to pin the problem of the sustainability of our food supply and blame it on people who are overweight. But that does add to the burden of how many calories our planet needs to produce in order to sustain us all. So if, you know, smaller bodies require less food and fewer calories to sustain. So I think we have to at least include that in our in our perspective.
And I don't off the top of my head have the number of handy of the people who are currently on the planet in 2019. But this report talks about 10 billion people needing to be fed by 2050. And if we think about it, that's 30
not very
years.
Far away. Yeah.
I mean, 30 years goes pretty quick.
Well, and when they're trying to get us to shift fundamentally some of the ways that we go about using our land, our water, our agricultural practices, and our eating practices, that ship is not going to turn around on a dime. So it's probably smart to be thinking now about what we need to start putting in motion now in order to be playing out in 30 years' time.
Monica Reinagle is the nutrition diva. We got a few minutes left with Monica for this edition of Smart Nutrition. If you'd like to let us know what you're eating these days, are you a vegan? Are you a carnivore? Are you an omnivore? Are you a pescatarian? Let us know what your diet is looking like and how it's working for you. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So there's a lot of talk in both in environmental circles and now and even in medical circles here with this report from The Lancet about sustainability and the impact that, you know, raising animals as opposed to plant-based things has on sustainability. People talk about all these cows. It's expensive to the environment to have all these cows lying around creating all this milk, right? It creates a lot of carbon and methane gas and all that kind of stuff, right? But if you have substitutes for cow's milk, right? Soy milk, almond milk, all these different kinds of milks. I mean, now you can get a gazillion different kinds of milks. Are those things in and of themselves sustainable? I mean, in that, looked at through that prism?
Well, you raise an interesting point here, and this is something that that beleaguers, people who are studying sustainability of food systems and trying to calculate the carbon footprint or the environmental impact of different sources of food, because you what is the life cycle that you're going to look at? So, you know, one thing that you can say about meat or milk or chicken or eggs is that it comes to our store in a fairly unprocessed way. You know, you put it in a carton. You line up the eggs in the carton. You pasteurize the milk and bottle it. You know, you cut the meat and wrap it, and there it goes. And we buy that stuff fresh and minimally processed. When we start creating the plant-based analogs for those, the soy milk and the texturized vegetable protein that we put in our chili instead of ground beef and all, a lot more processing has taken place. And all of that processing and packaging adds to the carbon emission and the footprint of those foods. So are we taking that into account, or are we stopping at our analysis at the side of the field and figuring out how, you know, much we spend to produce, you know, that many calories of milk versus that many calories of soybeans? So, you know, that's just one example of how incredibly complex this analysis becomes when you're trying to factor in not just the cost to grow it, but also how much processing takes place, how much packaging is involved, how much transportation is involved to ship it, you know, wherever it's going. And we want to make sure that we're looking at all of those systems, but it's hard.
One listener asked, what about protein from insects?
Ah, yes. Now, this is a very interesting development. This has been around now for, they call this micro-livestock.
Micro livestock.
Yeah.
There you
and
go.
And they're talking about
like the little G.I. Joes. Right. Are those micro warriors? What is it? My micro livestock.
Well, you can grow a lot of protein in very small in your garage, but you know, and they're talking about things like mealworms and crickets and various forms of insects that are very high in protein. It's very high quality protein. It is technically an animal-based protein. And is actually seen as a delicacy in certain parts of the world. You can buy fried crickets as a street food in certain parts of Asia. But this is absolutely revolting for a lot of Westerners to think about. But we are starting to see products in the stores, protein bars made out of cricket or muffin mix that's, you know, enhanced with mealworm protein. The nutritional quality of these products is great. And people who are involved in micro livestock like to make the point that the environmental cost is minimal in terms of land use and water and fertilizers and, you know, food and everything, that they can grow this protein extremely efficiently. I think we have a ways to go to convert the Western eater.
And evidently they're on the shelves at places like Mom's Market in Hamden. You can buy crickets and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Protein powders.
When we first met each other some 40 years ago in Boston, I lived in various apartments that had, you know, were very high in protein because there were creatures running all over the floors. And I just, you know, potential girlfriends would come over and I'd say, oh, it's just, you know, this, they're high in protein. That's my side hustle. It's good for you. Yeah. Well, Monica, always good to see you. Thank you so much. And we'll see you next time.
Can't wait.
Monica Ryan-Agel is the nutrition diva. She blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. We've got a link to her website at our website, wypr.org/midday, where you can sign up for Monica's newsletter and get her nutrition news and tips by email. Coming up, the intersection of food and theater. J. Wynn Russick reviews Charlie and the Chocolate Factory at Baltimore's Hippodrome Theater. I understand that the show was also left out of the Lancet report. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Thanks for that, by the way. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.